This is an ABC podcast.
We're breaking in to take you live to Canberra, where the Deputy Prime Minister, Barnaby Joyce, is speaking.
We are in support of a process going forward that would go towards a 2050 emissions target. Obviously, that's dependent upon what we see in the Cabinet submission, reflecting the conversations and the agreements between myself and the Prime Minister.
With 4 days to go before the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, boards a plane to Glasgow, there is finally majority support in both the Liberal and National parties for Australia to reach net zero emissions by 2050. The announcement of the in-principle deal came late yesterday afternoon by the Deputy Prime Minister and Nationals leader, Barnaby Joyce, even though all the details are still secret pending Cabinet approval.
I trust the Prime Minister impeccably on process going forward. Now, the details of that negotiated settlement will remain private.
I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre. And today on The Signal, what do we know so far about Australia's all but finalised net zero deal? And how does that brand new policy on emissions stack up on the world stage?
Could we get you just to introduce yourself for the tape?
Yes, David Spears, the host of Insiders.
All right, so it feels like it's been coming for possibly years at this point. But yesterday evening, after a meeting that went on for something like 2.5 hours, Barnaby Joyce stood up and announced that the Nationals had reached a position on net zero. They'd decided on a set of conditions to take back to the Liberal Party, to Scott Morrison. Does this mean that we finally have a deal on net zero?
Pretty much. The equivocation there is because all they've said is they support a process going forward. I think what we can interpret this to mean is, yes, they do back net zero by 2050 if the conditions they've all settled on are supported by Cabinet, which presumably they will be, but they're having difficulty in spitting out the words, for Nationals, for Barnaby Joyce in particular, to stand up and say, I now support net zero by 2050 is a very, very difficult thing for him to do. So all he's saying is, we've made our demands, we support this going forward, but, it's better to be in the tent than outside the tent.
We always make sure that no matter what we do, we give ourselves the best opportunity that the people who feel vulnerable in this process going forward know that they've got a champion who's going to stand up for them. And standing up for them is not standing outside. Standing up for them is making sure that you're in the room where the decisions are being made.
So, look, yes, it looks very much like the government is now on track to finalise what's been a painstaking negotiation between the coalition partners.
Now, for people who haven't been playing along with every little development here, you said that presumably the government will sign off on this, the cabinet, the Prime Minister will sign off on this. Why is that? Because there is a bit of a backstory here in terms of the back and forth between the two parties, right?
Yeah, this has been a torturous process. Now, ultimately, Cabinet has to make the final decision on this and will make the final decision on this. But that really is a fait accompli now. And this could have happened all week. Cabinet could have just rammed this through. Scott Morrison could have had his commitment to net zero and gone off to Glasgow. But he needs to have those Nationals on board. To go without the Nationals' support would have been incredibly messy. It would have divided the coalition. It would have led to resignations left, right and centre. So, look, this was the preferable way to do it from the Prime Minister's perspective. Now, look, we don't know exactly what concessions he's given the Nationals. They're tight-lipped on that. But presumably it's enough. The Nationals won't have got everything that every NAP would have wanted, but they would have got enough to get them over the line so that the Prime Minister and Cabinet can now agree to this and he can head off to Glasgow with his deal in the bag.
And Barnaby Joyce yesterday was being asked about some of the things that the Nationals may have got. One of the questions was about an extra seat in Cabinet.
Did you manage to get an extra Cabinet spot for the Nationals as part of this negotiation process?
Any decision that is made in regards an extra Cabinet position remains in the remit of the Prime Minister.
Everybody is assuming there's a lot of additional money going to the regions. Do you have a sense about what some of those things might be and when we will know what those conditions were?
Look, I think we'll certainly find out this week the details of the government's plan, because bear in mind, it's not just the Nationals' demands that we've been unable to see, but it's been the actual government's detail of its net zero plan that we still have not seen. Now, I suspect the Nationals, what they've got, yes, transitional support, and that means help, financial support for the regions and those affected industries.
What we went to the Prime Minister about was more around safeguards and mechanisms within existing policy settings to protect regional rural Australia, to make sure...
Like the socio-economic safety valve is what they're talking about.
Well, there's a lot of speculation about what that might look like and what was in that document. Well, I'm not going to divulge that.
It also will probably involve some changes to the EPBC Act. This is the Environmental Protection and Biodiversity Act, to give farmers and miners a bit more certainty around what they can and can't develop. But they're not going to get things like allowing nuclear power, domestic nuclear power industry in Australia. They're not going to get the sort of pause mechanism that Bridget McKenzie had been talking about that would have allowed the government to stop the net zero plan if the impact was too great in one particular region. I don't think these are things that Liberals and the Prime Minister would have agreed to. So, they'll get some of what they were after, but certainly not all.
And yesterday, Barnaby Joyce also told the media that there wasn't actually a vote on the matter.
I said that this was the position, not of the leader, not of the executive. We went through a process to find the view of the party room.
Was there a vote?
No, there was no vote. Okay, thank you.
Which does sort of make you wonder, like, how many dissenting voices are there still in the National Party room? Is this going to be a problem for Barnaby Joyce and the coalition more generally in the future if there is still a lot of dissent, even if it's in a minority?
I find this fascinating, actually. They did not take a vote. Now, there could be a number of reasons for that, one being that Barnaby Joyce didn't want to test the numbers, which would have become public eventually, and therefore expose just how divided the Nationals are. But we can safely assume that Matt Canavan, George Christensen, there's no way they would ever have supported net zero by 2050. There might have been a couple of others. So, look, it could have been a quarter, maybe even up to a third, who weren't supportive of this deal. But, look, there's no doubt that there was a majority in the room. I don't think Barnaby Joyce would have survived as leader had he not been confident and had the party room not understood that there was a majority in support. But just how strong that majority was, we may never know because there was no vote taken.
And might there be some resignations, both potentially from the party, but I'm thinking in the case of, say, Keith Pitt from the ministry?
Look, Keith Pitt, you're right, is the one to watch here, and we didn't hear from him last night. Bridget McKenzie was also pretty vocal in expressing a lot of concerns about this plan, but she was there standing alongside Barnaby Joyce in announcing the outcome of the party room meeting, so she's going nowhere.
I'm also very proud to be part of a political movement which doesn't shy away from the tough questions and that for the last 10 days has stood up for our people.
But Keith Pitt, look, he's the resources minister. He has very strong views when it comes to net zero. He's the one who wanted some sort of commitment to allow nuclear power to be considered in Australia and allowed in Australia.
You know how it is, mate. There's a moratorium in Australia. Until we can get support from the opposition, that won't change. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be looking at this technology as it develops.
He's the one who's been most concerned about the impact on the resources industry. So, yes, he's the one to watch here. But, look, no news at this stage that he's actually going to quit over this.
I was hoping you could give us a sense for, I guess, just how politically risky this move is for the Nats, because, you know, they have really been dragged to this position. They must hold a genuine fear about being punished by voters.
They are paranoid about Clive Palmer and Pauline Hanson, Bob Catter as well you could throw in the mix, but particularly Clive Palmer and the enormous pile of money that he is preparing to spend, as he did at the last election. Last election, he deployed it against the Labor Party. But this time around, is he going to deploy his enormous resources in the campaign against the Nationals, against the LNP in Queensland because of this net zero deal? That's what they're really worried about, losing votes on the right flank in a lot of these coal districts in Queensland. So that's where they've been coming from throughout this whole negotiation. For the government, though, more broadly, Scott Morrison has to worry about those more moderate Liberal seats in the cities, in Sydney and Melbourne in particular, where about half a dozen of his MPs are under threat from independent candidates who are campaigning squarely on this climate issue. They want the government to go a lot further. So, look, both Scott Morrison and Barnaby Joyce are under enormous political pressure on this. But we know the Prime Minister has wanted this net zero by 2050 deal. He's now got it by the looks of it, and he'll be able to head to Glasgow with that in the bag. He won't be increasing the 2030 target, and that's what will leave him exposed to those who do want more urgent action on climate change.
Do you think the theatrics around this negotiation between the two halves of the coalition has done enough to kind of ensure that they look like they fought this hard enough? You know, will that wash with voters, do you think?
Yeah, and look, your use of the word theatrics there I think is key because, you know, it clearly a lot of this has been the Nationals wanting to show for a week or more that they're really concerned, they're agonising, they're fighting, trying to get the best possible deal they can for the regions. Were they always going to do a deal? Look, I guess we'll never know. I know that a lot of the Nationals, though, genuinely hold concerns about net zero, but I think a fair bit of what we've seen over the last week has also been for show, to demonstrate to their voters that they are serious about fighting for a better deal. Now, what have they actually secured? Have they actually been able to fight and secure a better deal? Look, we still don't know the details, and we still don't know what the Nationals themselves have actually secured from the Liberals as part of this. I suspect a lot of this will come out in the coming days, but right now it is pretty hard to tell exactly what they've been able to secure because, yeah, those details still aren't there.
So what are the nuts and bolts of what happens from here, David?
Look, I think Scott Morrison will want to tie a bow around this and wrap it up as promptly as he can. I think the cabinet meeting isn't actually scheduled until tomorrow, Tuesday. But look, that could potentially be brought forward to get it all rubber stamped today so that he can then start talking about this and head off to Glasgow on Thursday. But either way, he'll be boarding that plane in the comfort and safety now of knowing he may not have any increase in the 2030 target, which the US, the UK, Europe, a lot of our allies want us to do, but at least he's got the bare minimum, the ticket for entry at Glasgow, and that is a net zero commitment by 2050.
But promising net zero and delivering it are two very different things.
Look, I don't think that Scott Morrison adopting a net zero goal will make any difference at all.
This is Dr. Bill Hare. He's a climate scientist and a director of a think tank called Climate Analytics.
I mean, everyone knows that in order to get onto a net zero pathway, you need to have pretty good targets and policies for 2030. And if they're not on the right way, then any promises made about 2050 are really not believable. And right now, the federal government has virtually no policies and virtually no action that will get us anywhere near deep reductions in 2030, let alone net zero.
So even with a destination all but declared, Bill is concerned that there's no path set out. Even though most Australian states and territories do have stronger 2030 targets than the country overall, Bill says there's a limit to what they can achieve without a federal framework.
Now, one possible rebuttal to that idea that there's no path set out is a policy that was released last month called the Technology Roadmap. Basically, it's a plan for how to carve up $18 billion worth of government investment, and it singled out five priority technologies, including hydrogen and carbon capture and storage. And even though the goal of that technology roadmap is reducing emissions, Bill says it misses the mark.
Look, if you unpack the technology roadmap, it won't reduce emissions very much at all, actually. And the really strange thing about the technology roadmap is it really ignores the technologies that actually are really reducing emissions in the Australian economy now. In particular, the rollout of renewable energy in the power sector, the need to roll out renewable energy in other sectors, and it ignores electric vehicles and a range of other practices and technologies that are actually working, and focuses on a number of technologies which are essentially hypothetical. They are claimed to work, but in general haven't.
So we wanted Bill to give us a sense for how Australia compares to its peers in a few areas. So in terms of overall targets, including for 2030, but also when it comes to how we're tracking towards those targets. In other words, the path to net zero.
Certainly on the top level emission commitments, we lag behind virtually all of our peers by a very wide margin. The areas that really matter for decarbonisation as well, that is, how carbon intensive is our total energy system? We don't compare very well with virtually any other countries. We have a very high proportion of coal in our total energy supply compared to our counterparts, who are generally declining faster. We see a very flat pattern of improvement of the share of renewables in our total energy system. The area where Australia is doing quite well is in particularly in the eastern states electricity market, where renewables are growing very quickly. Not the fastest in the world, but certainly amongst the fastest, and that's very positive. But that's not going to change the big curves in Australia. It's going to have a very important impact on short-term emission reductions, and in fact explains the reductions of the last 5 years or so very well. But there's going to be limits to that once we start to bottom out on the renewable front there. So electric vehicles as well, we're certainly way behind the US and China in terms of the volume of electric vehicles in our total stock. We're more or less at the bottom of the global scale at present. So whichever way you look at it, we're simply not doing very well.
What about, I guess, emissions reductions targets themselves, particularly 2030? What are other countries going to be taking to Glasgow in terms of a commitment there?
The countries in the developed world that are the closest to being in a 1.5-degree pathway are the United Kingdom.
In search of a new start on the world stage, the government has set an ambitious new climate change target that would see the UK cut carbon emissions further and faster than any other major economy.
So I'm very happy to say that we in the UK are going to lead by example, going further and faster than ever before with a new target to cut emissions by at least 68%. By 2030.
The European Union and Germany are getting very close. So these countries have very deep targets compared to Australia, well over 55-65% reductions by 2030. And they're leading the way. And, you know, I think the interesting thing is also to look at the UK experience and how rapidly they've been able to phase out of coal. Now, all of these countries have the other thing which shouldn't be forgotten, which is that they have these deep targets, but their policies don't match those yet. Some are closer than others, and I guess if you think about it, that's normal. You put forward a target in 10 years' time and your policies need to follow.
Okay, so those are the strongest targets, all much stronger than Australia's. Although, as Bill says, like Australia, those countries haven't necessarily worked out how they're getting there yet. Then at the other end of the spectrum, there are a few countries that are trailing behind us, some that have already declared their targets in part or in full, like Russia and Saudi Arabia, which have both announced in recent days they intend to reach net zero by 2060. And then there are others that are yet to declare.
New Zealand, for example, their present target is really, I think, quite outrageous. It's, when you unpack the wording of it, it would allow New Zealand to increase its emissions by 4%. To be fair, I understand that New Zealand will be moving to announce a new target within the next few weeks, and I'm really hoping that that redresses that. Korea is, I would say, borderline. It hasn't moved as much as it could have and should have. So it's, I think, lagging on the commitment front as well. So overall, Australia's not right at the bottom of the pack. It's close to it. But that doesn't excuse us in any way from the need to really lift our game.
What should we be taking to Glasgow in the way of targets?
Well, I think at the very least we should be taking what our direct peers are taking, which is, if you take the US as an example, at least a 50 to 55% reduction. I think that's absolutely critical for any credibility for Australia, and also to help the rest of the world move forward as well. I mean, there's a leadership issue here as well, that a lot of countries are looking around and saying, well, what are you big rich guys doing? Are you really getting on and taking measures? And if not, why should we? And Australia has a very direct interest in the rest of the world taking deep action. We are very, very vulnerable here. We've got a number of our natural systems on the front line of climate change. We've got major risk to our agricultural sector from climate change. We've got health costs rising. We also know that the global financial markets are moving very quickly. We've got the work that was released by the Business Council of Australia. We've got the work that was released by the World Wide Fund for Nature and colleagues last week, showing hundreds of thousands of extra jobs coming from these new technologies. And we are just going to miss the curve unless we get in and get decent targets and get our economy moving in the right direction.
That's The Signal for today. If you want to reach us, our email is thesignal@abc.net.au, and we'll be back here tomorrow. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.